Are you a gamer? Now think about it for a moment. Maybe not the stereotypical teenager down in the basement blasting zombies on your big screen TV. But did you play Candy Crush on the bus this morning? Yeah, I'm talking to you, one with the Candy Crush. Have a word with friends, spend time walking in line, milking virtual cows in Farmville. And nothing to be ashamed about today because, as you know, gaming is mainstream, and that means game makers have the potential to reach millions of players. And what if games they designed did more than just, well, help pass the time on the bus? What if games could make us healthier? My next guests believe games could help improve your cognitive health and understanding of diseases. They are gamer scientists, and they just got through presenting their latest projects at the Games for Change Festival here in New York. Let me introduce them to you. Adam Ghazali is Associate Professor of Neurology, Physiology, and Psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco. And Zoran Popovich is Professor of Computer Science and Engineering at the University of Washington. He joins us from Seattle. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
The whole idea is to try to make games for health. Adam, your background is in neuroscience. How did you get started in designing games?
Well, we've been using game design mechanics to challenge the brain and record activity to understand how the brain works. And the idea was that instead of just challenging at a light level just to activate those circuits as a neuroscience goal, we can apply more advanced game mechanics to really push on those processes using game design and then actually change the brain.
Mm-hmm. And Zoran, you designed your game Folded to address a very real scientific problem. What was that?
Yeah, it was a game now already 5 years in existence where people from all over the world were able to actually enter the very beginning of a scientific process of discovering the structures of proteins. And over the course of last 2 or 3 years, publish 3 Nature papers on the outcomes specifically produced by the game.
And in fact, the folding of proteins, people's brains are much better than computers at this, aren't they?
For some specific types of tasks, yes, they're absolutely better, especially when it comes to designing new proteins and more recently even drugs, because that leverages creativity, which computers are pretty bad at as a rule.
But do you have to be a biochemist to be good at this game?
No, absolutely not. In fact, most biochemists, which originally started playing this game, quickly left the game because they were pummeled by ordinary people from all over the world who had sort of spatial visual skills that were significantly better, or at least they were able to develop them to such an incredible level.
Wow.
They're resolving these proteins now. They're doing amazing stuff.
They were embarrassed by the newbies coming in and doing their lifelong work. Let me remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI. Public Radio International. Adam, tell us about your game NeuroRacer. Why did you develop this game?
Yeah, so in general, the goal was to design and develop customized games that target limitations in how our brains process information. And NeuroRacer was specifically designed to target vulnerability in the brains of older adults in terms of cognitive control, which is the set of skills that allow us to interact in complicated environments based on our goals. So the game involved a high amount of interference, both distraction and multiple tasks that had to be engaged in at the same time. And the idea was that by challenging their brains in this way, adaptively, such that the game scales its difficulty as our older players get better at it, that we'd be able to improve how their brains process information in this type of environment, and then that we would see a benefit on other skills that are related to those that we trained in the game.
So by actually playing the game, people actually benefited? Their brains got a little exercise, and they got better at doing things?
Exactly. So we saw that they got better at multitasking in the game itself, even our 60-year-olds, even exceeding the levels of 20-year-olds who played it on a single time. But we also found that some skills, cognitive skills, using other tests that were not particularly or specifically trained by the game, such as memory for faces over short periods of time and a vigilance task, also improved selectively in our training group. So that was a really exciting finding, that not only the skills in the game got better, better, but related cognitive abilities also seem to improve.
Is it a very hard game to play?
It's hard, but what's
What do you do in this game?
Yeah, so in this game, you have two challenges. One is to hold a car on a road that's winding, and you move a joystick left or right or up or down to increase the speed. And so you have to keep the car on the road, and at the same time, signs are being presented, and you have to respond as rapidly and as accurately only to your target sign. And so you have these two tasks that you have to juggle at the same time, and as you get better on each of them, the challenge increases. And the rewards in the game really only happen when both skills get better, so you can't trade off. So it forces your brain to figure out how to do these two challenges simultaneously, which is actually very hard for our brains to do.
Mm-hmm. And as you say, the more you played it, the better you get at it?
Yeah, we had older adults play this game for 12 hours over the course of a month, so 1 hour a day, 3 days a week. And we recorded what happened in their brains before and after using EEG. And we could see that there was a really robust increase in the activation of the frontal part of their brain, the prefrontal cortex, that occurs at the most challenging point in the game that was deficient compared to younger adults before gameplay, but reached or even exceeded many younger adults after gameplay. Mm. And the amount that this brain activity change occurred, or which those individuals where it occurred the most, showed the most improvement on skills that were not trained by the game. So it teaches you how you can sort of put pressure on the brain to lead to these benefits.
So when can I get this game downloaded as an app or on my Mac or something?
Well, what's happening now is I helped co-found a company called Achille Interactive Labs, and they're bringing the game out of the laboratory, which you really need to do. You can't really build these products in a lab. And they're not putting the game on the App Store. Their plan is actually to see if this new version of the game that they're developing, and I serve as an advisor for them, if it can be validated as a therapeutic tool. So it's going to go through pathways on the way to the FDA to see if it can become, prescribable video game.
I have to wait for my Medicare to pay for this then.
Possibly.
Possibly. All right. We'll talk more about games. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk about games for health. If you'd like to join us, our number is 844-724-8255. 844-SciTalk. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Maybe you have an idea for a game that you'd like to suggest. And we'll send it to the game experts here. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about gaming and health. Could gaming lead to the development of new disease-fighting drugs? Could a simple tablet game improve your memory? We're talking with Adam Ghazali, Associate Professor of Neurology, Physiology, and Psychiatry, University of California, San Francisco. Zoran Popovic, Professor of Computer Science and Engineering at the University of Washington. Zoran, you debuted a game this week at the Games for Change Festival called NanoCrafter. What does that game do? How could it affect health?
Yeah, one of the more recent things that we discovered with Foldit is that as we were trying to sort of design drugs that interact in the appropriate way with proteins, it became obvious that sort of people and their creativity and ability to design things from building blocks is just really amazing. It actually exists even as early as elementary school for a lot of people. So a lot of scientific contributions can be made by even wider population of people. So then we looked at basically the field of synthetic biology, which is basically figuring out how to use molecules, in our case, DNA structures, for purposes that nature is actually not using as of now. So sort of how do you use the same tools that nature is using, but for completely different purposes? So in this case, NanoCrafter is turning the DNA design into a problem that kind of looks like crafting things with Legos. So you build structures with Legos, you can put little motors, and all of a sudden you can start creating these little molecular walkers that transport atoms or molecules from one place to another. And as you can imagine, a whole new set of possibilities emerges when you can sort of design new things like that. And NanoCrafter enables every person to start from scratch and be able to sort of design these new structures in a very short period of time.
If I'm playing NanoCrafter, am I working on my own as a freelancer or as a gamer, or am I working for a drug company?
Well, even with Folded, we had the same. You obviously working for yourself, but actually more frequently you working as a group. It's uh-huh. clear to us that every time the best outcomes always come through a sort of collective intelligence that happens from many people applying their skills towards often very, very hard problems.
One of the reasons I'm asking is, if I come up with something really good in synthetic biology, who gets the intellectual property rights to this thing that I've designed?
Yeah, this is something that we're actually really struggling to do. We're talking to lawyers now about how to have University of Washington basically be the sort of protector of rights, which really have to be maintained and kept in public. And this is clearly the desire of all the Folded players at the same time. But, you know, you have this issue of if something actually is ready to be sort of synthesized in a laboratory, or even longer down the road, further down the road, maybe even going to trials, somebody actually needs to build it, or right, maybe even right. create a drug. And then you really need to involve all these other entities. So there's a sort of a completely new pathway towards scientific discovery that we've come up here. And the entire structure is sort of collectively scratching heads, trying to figure out how can we sort of leverage this in the standard mechanism with which discoveries are happening today.
You know, Adam, when you start talking about brain functioning, dysfunctioning, games to improve memory, people are going to want to know, because so many people are getting to that age group, right? And with people getting older and losing their memories and having trouble remembering things, people are going to want to know, when do I get my hands on this sort of thing? Can you give us any idea when some of this might be in our doctor's offices, if you're talking about it as a doctor's tool?
Yeah, it's a great question. The field is really still in its infancy, and it goes through, as all fields do, a period of tremendous enthusiasm and lots of maybe even overinflated claims. And then it pauses and recalibrates. And if there's something real there, it grows more slowly. And I think we're at that stage now where we're applying all, you know, the scientific tools and approaches to really validate what works and what doesn't work before we can make strong recommendations. And this is really important. I mean, saying that video games help you or hurt you doesn't really mean anything. It's like saying that drugs help you or hurt you, or food. It depends on the ingredients right. and what it is and which population and what dosage and how it's targeted. And so that's the responsibility now, is to really figure out what works before we make recommendations, especially clinical recommendations. And so it could still be a couple of years until these well-controlled studies occur and get approved and the papers get produced, and then the medical community starts accepting it and they're willing to prescribe it right alongside traditional pharmaceuticals. So that's, you know, it's a big change of culture, and, you know, we have a lot more work to do until that happens.
Should we be wary of any websites that profess that you play games on our websites and your memory's going to be improved, or, you know?
Well, I think we should be wary about any claims. It's appropriate to question things and to also look at a difference between what is being claimed to be based on science and what's actually been validated by scientific methods. And they're not the same thing. And it's unfortunate when science is used as a you know, sword like that to gain confidence. But the truth is, it's not hard to base things on science. Mm-hmm. What's more challenging is to validate through scientific methodology, careful controlled studies, and peer review publications. That is what, if you're being critical about what you're being served, you should be looking
right.
for.
A little more gold standard. I'd like to add another voice to our conversation. Richard Tate is Vice President of Communications at Hopewell Lab, an organization that's developed several games to support young cancer patients through their treatment. He joins us from Oakland, California. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you, Ira. Pleasure to be with you and Zoran and Adam in the conversation.
Tell us about your game. We've been talking a lot about what games could do to make us healthier. Let's talk about what Hope Lab's games are already doing. Tell us about the remission games.
Well, Hope Lab is really focused on using the power and appeal of technology to help people tap into their resilience to live healthier lives. And if you think about a cancer diagnosis, there are few things more challenging that require resilience than cancer. And for young people in particular, it's a real challenge to engage them effectively in the treatments. One of the interesting things that's emerged in the last few decades is that we have effective treatments to cure or treat many diseases, including some forms of adolescent cancer. But the real challenge is getting people to stick to their medications, getting young people, in our case with the remission games, to stick to their treatments as they're being prescribed. Mm-hmm. So the remission games are designed to engage young cancer patients in experiences and games that are fun and engaging, but also map to the experience of what it's like to fight your cancer. The games put you inside the body of fictional cancer patients and arm you with weapons like chemotherapy and antibiotics and even the body's natural defenses. And your job is to destroy cancer and win. And that experience, based on the research that we've conducted and our experience working with hospitals and clinics around the world, is that that gameplay can actually change the way that young patients engage with their treatment. They stick to their chemotherapy and their antibiotics more consistently, and that leads to better outcomes for them.
So they're shooting bad cancer cells in the game and at the same time motivated to stay on their medication, stay on the regimen, not forget to take it?
Absolutely. There's a concept in psychology, self-efficacy, this notion that you can do what it takes to fight your disease or to overcome a particular circumstance. And part of what we see the games doing is boosting that sense of self-efficacy, engaging young people and tapping into their own resilience to help them do what it takes to fight the disease and win.
And they believe that they could win. I mean, the game showed them that they could win. And that's what motivates them to stay on the medications, I imagine.
Yeah, it's absolutely a game that sort of gives you an experience of fighting back. And that was part of the original idea. The idea of it for the game comes from our founder, Pam Omidyar, who actually worked in an immunology lab growing up cancer cells for research and was an avid gamer and wondered what would happen if you let people blast away at their cancer in a video game. What might that do in terms of their health? And yes, that experience, based on some research that we published in Pediatrics in 2008, showed that young people who play the remission game actually increase their cancer knowledge, boost their self-efficacy, but again, more importantly, they stick to their cancer medications more consistently, and they stick to their antibiotics. And that's the real challenge in the clinical setting.
Let me bring back Adam and Zoran. Adam, for a game to be successful, right, people have to want to play it. How do you balance the science that you want to have done and the fun in playing the game?
That is, in many ways, the ultimate challenge, or one on the list. How we do it in our lab is that we work very closely with game professionals, designers, artists, developers, you know, the whole host of different skill sets that go into making a game fun, which is very hard to do. And we balance their motivation, which is to create something that's fun and engaging and immersive, with the underlying goal of pushing on a process in the brain and keeping the science really clean. So that just takes a lot of careful communication between two groups of people that do something that is very different on the surface. And so what I've found over the years is that it really involves a lot of trust and respect, mutual respect, to actually listen to each other and not feel either on the science side or the game side that you know how it should look in the end, and really go through that process of creativity and creation together and keep moving back and forth as you travel. And then, you know, it takes a long time and it takes a lot of testing, but it's possible, and we've done that several times now, and it's really gratifying when you wind up with something at the end that preserves all the scientific elements that you baked into it, but also winds up being a lot of fun.
Well, Richard, you must have had that challenge with the kids.
Absolutely. I think, as Adam described, it can be challenging enough to bring great scientific minds and really creative game developers together to sort of achieve a goal that's beyond what traditional gaming and game projects are about. One of the things that was really critical for us in developing Remission was engaging young people themselves, engaging young cancer patients in that development process to let us know what was fun for them, what was engaging for them, what was challenging for them in the cancer experience that they wanted to see translated into a game that empowered them to fight back. And ultimately, when we got stuck, and we often did in the development process, trying to create something that was really cool and fun from a game development perspective, but something that was supported by the research and the evidence from a scientific perspective, the kids helped us decide. They helped us decide what was going to be fun and effective for them. As you said, Ira, the games can't possibly work if people don't play them. And so that's one critical aspect of game development I think we all have to pay attention to.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about creating games to keep you healthy or make you more healthy. Let's go to the phones. Our number is 844-724-8255. On the line, Jordan from New Milford, Connecticut. Hi, Jordan.
Hello.
Hey there.
How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Great to be here.
Go ahead.
So I work as a gaming journalist for website blackmanandrobin.com. I'm the editor-in-chief, and one trend that I've been noticing is that we've seen quite a spike in what we're calling empathy games, games that are about putting you in the shoes of another person who might be suffering from some sort of mental illness. For example, we recently got Will O'Neill's Actual Sunlight. I'm about to get started on that one. Or Zoe Quinn's Depression Quest, which puts you into the life and times of a person suffering depression. And what these games do is they're not really meant so much for the people who suffer from these ailments, but not just for people around them. Let's say you have a friend with depression, but you don't understand exactly what it is he's going through. These games are meant to put you into his or her shoes and let you know what exactly is going on.
Quite interesting. Gentlemen, any reaction to that?
What I love about those examples is that it underscores the power of games to really influence our psychological experience of the world. And even though the remission games that we've created were really focused on young cancer patients, we hear anecdotally from the field that siblings of young cancer patients or classmates or other family members play the games and have an empathetic response, or they begin to understand more intimately what's happening for their loved one. And that's a really powerful aspect of games that can actually connect people. And if you think about games, they're not cures in and of themselves necessarily, but what they can do is connect people and rally their support and engage their relationships to help them be more resilient. So I think that's a great possible pioneering space for games.
Thanks for that call, Jordan. What are games allow you to do that other media do not? Why design a game to solve these problems?
Well, I was going to say, even upon hearing that last caller, is that it just highlights how how much variety there is in the type of games that could be designed, including the three, of us that are on this call, and that call bringing up another avenue. And, we have here the most, it's potentially the most powerful form of media in that it's interactive and that it's fun and engaging, and it's clearly a strong influencer of behavior. So if you can take that core element of it and then direct it towards different outcomes, it can be a powerful source of impact. So I think that's really the underlying force of it, and then it can be applied using all the various game mechanics that exist along so many different lines, and we're just hearing about several of them now. There are many more.
And especially with kids and the younger generation, you're talking to a generation that grew up with games, right?
And they're playing them anyway.
And increasingly, Ira, there are clinicians and people working in healthcare who've grown up with games. Many of us, are of an age where, we had those original consoles. One of the things I think that's really important about your question is that, traditionally in healthcare, we've printed lots of materials. When we got sophisticated, there were DVDs and videos that we asked people to watch. We did a bit of research to try to answer this question. What is it about games or the remission game that was actually changing the way that patients behaved? And part of what was happening when we looked at fMRI data was that it was actually motivating patients. It was lighting up motivational centers. It wasn't this sort of passive viewing of information. And we often lecture people or give them things to read, but that's different than engaging them in an experience that allows them to make choices and to experience contingencies, both successes and failures, that then inform the way that they engage with the real world.
Gentlemen, we've run out of time. Fascinating. I want to thank you all for taking time to be with us today. Adam Ghazali is Associate Professor of Neurology, Physiology, and Psychiatry at UC San Francisco. Zoran Popovich, Professor of Computer Science and Engineering at the University of Washington. Richard Tate, Vice President of Communications at Hope Lab. Thank you all for taking time to be with us again.
Our pleasure.
You.